outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, your home for deer hunting news, stories, and strategies. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kenyon, and this is episode number 354. And today on the show, I'm joined by Meat Eater Wild Foods contributing editor, Daniel Pruitt, to discuss everything you need to know to make this your very best summer of wild game cookouts. All right, welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, brought to you by Onyx. Today on the show, I'm joined by Danielle Pruitt. She is a contributing editor over at Meat Eater and the founder of Wild and Whole, a dedicated website to cooking and eating wild game. You might have heard her on the podcast, I don't know, about half a year ago during the holiday time period. She's a wealth of knowledge when it comes to cooking, preparing, and eating venison and other wild game. And I thought with summer officially kicked off now, it was time to talk summer cookout. So I wanted to pick Danielle's brain on all sorts of topics and ideas related to cooking outside and eating great wild game that's kind of fitting for this time of year and this season. So we cover all your favorite summer food ideas, everything from grilling the perfect venison steak or burger to Mexican night ideas to thoughts on barbecues and marinades and rubs and even sloppy joes, just all sorts of great summer eating. So if you've got a freezer full of wild game and an outdoor space to enjoy it, whether that's a deck, a boat, or a campsite, this is the podcast for you. So, without further ado, let's get into it. All right, with me now on the line is Danielle Pruitt. Welcome back to the show, Danielle.
Hey, Mark.
It's good to get to chat with you again. Last time we talked, it was just before Christmas, I think, right in that time frame. So everyone's thinking holiday foods, and now We're talking just before summer. And everyone's thinking summer food. So it seemed like a really good time to connect with you again. I'm getting hungry thinking about the summertime.
I know. It seems like this is the time of the year. Just everybody knows that Memorial Day is coming up. And it's just like, it's official. Summer is here. And I'm going to, since everybody's quarantined at home and we're all sick of dishes, like what better time to just crack that grill open or fire and cook outside.
Yes.
Stop with the messes in the kitchen.
Agreed. I am very sick of dishes. I've been doing a whole lot of those, and I'm excited for some outdoor eating and still dishes, but for some reason it'll feel better. You said Memorial Day, which when we're recording this, it's just a couple days, I don't know, 4 days before Memorial Day, something like that. I don't know what we're eating yet, but do you? Do you know what's on the Memorial Day menu?
No, mostly because it's going to be pouring down rain in Houston, which makes it kind of rains on the parade a little bit of the old outdoor get outside stuff. But that's a good like thing. Like, what am I cooking this weekend? I get so wrapped up in what I'm cooking for Meat Eater or for work or content wise, and then my husband's like, that all sounds great. So, like, what are we eating now? And I'm like, oh, I have no idea. I haven't thought about that.
Yeah. So, do you guys eat as good at home as you make food for the website? Or does your husband get stuck with leftovers and the good stuff just gets made for the camera?
Well, now that he's working from home, he gets to eat pretty darn good. Because most of the stuff I do it in the middle of the daytime. And so when he was working in the office, he had to miss out on that and had to eat leftovers. And so now he gets to be a part of everything. But like, for instance, yesterday I made some Neapolitan style pizzas.
Nice.
And I've been doing a little foraging, and I had a handful of chanterelles. And so I did like a pizza bianca with all those mushrooms, and it was so good. It was so good. I'm like, I rarely make pizzas, but that was memorable.
Yeah, that sounds
so the kind of stuff we eat. Pretty normal.
Do you guys eat different when you're at your ranch? Because you're at your ranch right now, right? In Texas.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there like a certain, mm-hmm. when you guys are there, do you have like any kind of, I don't know, like when I go certain places, like, okay, this is the kind of place I'm always going to grill out. Do you have something that, like, yeah. when you're here, it's this kind of food that just seems to fit the location?
Yeah, yeah. So my ranch is an hour away, and I'll just give you a quick backstory. I think it's a very cool place. It's my husband's family ranch. A guy named Wint Winthall, right after World War I, bought this property, and he got married, had one girl, and so the ranch passed to her, and she married Travis's grandfather. And so that's kind of how it got into the Pruitt family, because this property, the original house is still here, and we've kind of built an add-on around the original house, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really a cool place because there are pictures. I mean, gosh, that's like getting around 100 years old.
Yeah.
This area. And so there's pictures like you can see of parts of the ranch where, you know, they were practically homesteading. I mean, not homesteading, but, you know, what you did in 1930s, you lift off the land.
Yeah.
You know, it's really cool. Like the garden space that I have my garden in now has been gardened by the family for like 100 years. And so like we have dewberries out here. And so like every time I like pick or forage or do anything out here, I just think like how much family history is out here. And this part of the state of Texas is particularly known for, watermelon and okra, especially now that summer is approaching. And there's a farmer's market down the road that I just adore, because this is like the farmer's market where you know, it's all open air, and you go in and they have popcorn machines filled with chicharrones.
Wow.
It's just like, it's such a unique little place.
They don't have those up by me.
And the barbecue joint is down the road. And like, I say we're known for the watermelons here because when we lived in North Dakota, one time I was at the grocery store and I saw a Diario's watermelon. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. This is from Hempstead, Texas. Are you kidding me? So whenever we come out here, like, we really kind of play into some sort of like the Southern comfort foods. Like, we grill okra pretty much every single time. My husband could eat okra all day, every day. And pickled things, like, you know, just sort of really simple foods, nothing fancy, but kind of like a Southern twist to everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds pretty good. Do you find, kind of similar to how you have some things that come to mind for a location when you go out to the ranch, some of those types of foods sound particularly good, or they're local for you. Do you have the same thing at all with the season? So when it comes to this time of year, when Memorial Day hits and summer arrives, are there some things that all of a sudden, like, this is going to be on the Pruitt menu for the next couple months? There's like some summer mainstays. What are those for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, so for me, like, here in Texas, the zone that we're in, like, I kind of, okay, let me back up for a second. I think it's really important to eat seasonally, mostly because the food is, you know, from a cook perspective, the food is just 10 times better. If you've ever tried to eat a tomato in the middle of winter, it's terrible. Like, it's just terrible. It's just not good. And so, like, you know, when summer comes around, it's fantastic. So I always try to eat whatever is ripe, either at the grocery store, at the farmer's market, because everything just tastes so much better that way. But this time of the year here, what's ripe for me is probably definitely not in season for you now.
Yeah.
So, like, it's kind of weird, like, when I tell people, oh, I'm already finding chanterelles and my tomatoes are, one of them is already turning orange. It's all starting to ripen. And other people are like, I still have snow on the ground.
Right.
How is that possible?
Seeds aren't on the ground yet.
So, like, I'm in a little bit of a different, like, setting just because of location. But yeah, this time of the year is when I think about, well, it's hot. What's really refreshing and easy to cook? And, you know, obviously there's a lot of grilling outside, but I use a lot of fresh ingredients and serve them cold on the side. So, like, my favorite is, like, a steak with, like, not even like a backstrap steak, but any kind of tender cut of meat from a deer, and serve it with, like, a cold chimichurri sauce or some sort of, like, pickled relish. Anything that's kind of cold, acidic, just naturally, or acidity pairs really well with wild game that I find.
Mm-hmm.
But something that's kind of cooling, because it's already in the 90s here. And so I'm, like, really ready to just cook outside and not have an oven or anything going in the inside the house.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, this ranch house has no AC. As I'm saying this, I'm like, God, that sounds really good. I need a fan in here.
Yeah, I complain. We don't have AC at my house, but that's in Michigan. It's much less uncomfortable than I'm sure no AC in Texas is.
Well, I mean, there is an AC, but when I come out here for the day, that's just me. I don't turn it on. We only turn it on if we're planning on being here for a whole weekend or something.
Yeah. You know, something I got to wondering, you mentioned how, you know, there's certain types of foods that taste best fresh. You want to eat, you know, mm-hmm. for the season, ripeness like that. And, like, tomatoes are best, you know, right off the vine maybe. But it's kind of funny with wild game, with venison, a lot of the time we're eating it, you know, months later. Have you looked into it all, like, when the very best, like, what's the sweet spot for how long you should wait to eat venison? Like, there's some that will eat it right away, which has got a certain specialness to it. But then there's questions about, like, freezer aging your meat and how long it's in there. Is it great at 6 months? Is it better? I've heard some people say
that's a thing, freezer aging.
I don't know. Well, I am not the person to ask that question, but I've heard people use that term before. I've heard people say.
I've never heard of that in my life.
I've heard some people say.
I need to Google this.
Look into it. Someone has told me.
What kind of cook am I?
Someone
don't know about this.
Yeah, like a year later.
I understand, like, aging in the terms of when an animal dies, you know, you've got the rigor mortis. I have a hard time saying that for whatever reason.
Sounds right.
You've got that going on and the muscles stiffen up. And so when you let it hang or age, those enzymes that are still present in those muscles will continue to break down tissue even after the animal is dead. And so after that stiffness lets go, you know, like a day or two later, then the muscles relax and those enzymes continue to sort of digest that protein. And that's what aging really is. It's doing two things. It's tenderizing, and also because it's in a dry environment with airflow, it is sort of dehydrating in a sense, so that you're concentrating those flavors. And so it's a more bolder, meatier, savory, and tender flavor. And, you know, I used to get real wrapped up in that kind of stuff, and I kind of veered away with it. Just because I eat so much wild game that I don't know, I don't have the time for it. I do age in the fridge. You can do it in like a wet aging. Like what I just described is known as dry aging. You can do a wet aging, which is vacuum sealing. But I've had both good results and also bad results with that. And so I'm kind of, I guess the more and more I cook wild game, which has been living solely off wild game for 7 years now, I kind of try a lot of things and I go back and forth, and I'm way less rigid these days when it comes to stuff like that. And I don't get too wrapped up in how that's all, is it aged? And I think it's fun to do if you have the setup and you have the time and you're really investing into it, then it's great. But if you don't, like, you're not, you know, you're not missing out on the whole world.
Yeah, it's not gonna ruin the meat. Eating.
Yeah.
Now, what about the opposite?
I don't know anything about freezer aging.
I was gonna say, what's like the longest it can go in the freezer before you wouldn't want to eat it? You know, I've heard some people say, I was digging around the freezer. I found this package here at the bottom that's from 4 years ago. What should I do with it? Can I still eat it? What are your thoughts on that?
That's a really good question, because I just took out a package of goose breast from 2017.
Test it out.
They were vac sealed. And like, the problem is, you have to ask yourself how much fat is on that animal. If you're talking about a deer, there's way more leniency because there's not the same type of fat like you would find on bear meat or like a fatty duck or goose, because the fat is really what goes rancid the fastest. So when I defrosted that bag, it smelled pretty bad, but not too terrible. And I've kind of gotten to a point, because I've dealt with freezer burnt meat so many times. Sometimes I have to throw it away, which is just makes me want to cry. And I tell myself, Danielle, stop letting meat sit in the freezer for that long. Shame on me. But I've also kind of like figured out that if you have like a really good boning or fillet knife, you can take a thin slice off the top. And usually you can kind of solve the problem that way.
Yeah.
And then my other suggestion is cooking it in something like really, really bold in flavors. So like with that goose, I made gumbo with it and you couldn't tell at all. I actually had friends over for dinner and I was terrified. I was serving them frostbitten goose. I was like, why am I serving this to them? And they had no idea. They thought it was awesome.
That's great.
So there is a limit. I would say for deer, I don't like going more than 2 years. I think 2 years is definitely, I mean, I think it depends on how much game you have. If you're hunting every year for a variety of species or more than one deer, you know, you should really try to clean it out before the next season rolls around, because it's just going to sit in there even longer. Like, when do you actually get to it, you know?
Yeah. I'm usually about a year and a half rotation, I would say. So I'm eating,
that's a good number.
Yeah, I feel like I'm eating a lot of venison right now that was killed in the 2018 season. I'm eating a lot of that stuff right now. So
yeah,
by the time hunting season comes around, I will be getting probably done with that, and I'll be eating my 2019 deer probably by this fall. So usually, yeah, year and a half is what I'm behind, I would say. And that's been fine for me, I'd say. Most of my stuff, you know, if it might be a little bit of freezer burn, like you mentioned, you just trim that off, and then it's great from what I found.
Do you vac seal or do you use paper?
So I used to vac seal, but I have a lot of those bags like fail on me. So I'll pull out a vac seal bag and it's not sealed, you know, tight anymore. And so then there's these gaps that then allow that freezer burn to start. So my just saran wrap and paper just seems to be while it's a little bit more work, I guess, on the front end, maybe it just seems to be more consistent. And maybe that's my vacuum sealer. That could be like a error in how I'm doing it or the equipment or something, but for whatever reason, that's what I've found. What about you?
Yeah, I've had the same exact issues. I still use the vac sealer because when it works, then you've got like a year more of life. When it doesn't work, you notice immediately, you know, like once the meat's frozen, like it doesn't take but a month or so that you can see if there's frost in that package.
Yeah.
Then you know something's wrong and get it, you know, defrost it. Don't like bury it at the bottom of the freezer. And that's kind of the way I treat it. You know, I have this bad habit of wanting to savor my meat. Like, I found some sandhill crane breasts that we're going to have tonight for dinner that was shot 2 seasons ago. And like, I see it all the time and I'm like, we should have that. And I'm like, no, let's save that for something special. And then yeah. All of a sudden you take it out and you're like, oh, actually it's not special anymore. It's a little off. I'm the worst about doing that. And I think part of it, somebody said this and I think they kind of hit the nail on the head. When you finish off like the last package of meat, it's like you finished the hunt. Like it makes me a little sad.
It's an interesting one. I like that.
Do you have that?
You know, I think there's something to be said about that. Yes. When that last, because every time I eat, I know what deer it was. And I will always think of that deer. I'll think of that hunt. I'll think of that moment. And so, yeah, you're right. Like I know that when the last package, which I'm getting very close to it, of the buck I killed in Michigan a couple of years ago. That was a real special one. That'll be a weird ending, which is interesting way to think about it.
Yeah.
Good food though. But, at least it'll go out on a high note.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, and what you mentioned a little bit ago, you talked about how, you know, one of those go-to summer meals is grilling something and then having like a cold side, like a chimichurri sauce or something along those lines. I feel like I just want to get from you what we absolutely have to know about grilling better venison steaks. Because last time we talked about backstraps, but I think we mostly talked, you know, like cast iron stove kind of thing. But if we're outside cooking on the deck or the patio or whatever, let's talk about outdoor cooking and on the grill with venison, various cuts, whatever. Can you run through a few common mistakes or a few things that we should definitely be doing to make sure it's as good as possible? Give me like the high level masterclass on becoming a great griller.
I feel like I'm still learning how to grill. I shouldn't probably have said that. I feel like I'm still learning how to cook too, but,
always be learning.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's kind of this, I used to go back and forth, you know, you always hear pull your meat from the fridge early and get your grill hot. And like, what is early? Is it 10 minutes? Or is it 15?
Right.
You know, I used to be like, well, 10 minutes is pretty good, but it's actually not. It's still pretty cold. And I used to let it rest or pull it like at least 30 minutes early. And I noticed that definitely made for more even cooking. But if you're the kind of person that like has this tendency of overcooking, I know so many people that cook it cold because they're like, well, I'm not going to overcook it because I'm cooking it cold. And I'm like, well, you know, there's some truth to that, but you definitely get a little bit of that, black and blue sort of thing, which a lot of people like.
What does that mean for people that don't know?
Black and blue. Am I saying that? Is that the right term?
No, I think
or what is it? Is it the Chicago or there's a Detroit style, Pittsburgh style? That's what it is.
Beats me. I'll take your word for it. I'm assuming you mean like really cold still on the inside.
It's like where the outside is like super charred. And then it's still like rare in the middle.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool and rare in the middle, but the outside's really char. And that's because it's cold, cooked cold. I hate the char on the outside. I think it just overpowers the flavor so much. I mean, I want a little bit, but that particular style is just way too much. And so when you really think about that, you have to take two things into consideration. How early are you pulling, meaning like how cold is your meat versus how hot is your fire? The hotter your fire is, the more the outside's going to cook. So if you want like a blazing hot fire, you better pull that meat really, really early, if that makes sense. So it's not so cold in the middle. Otherwise, you get it like blackened on the outside and cold in the middle. which is a really common mistake. But I think having the patience to, if you're going to cook over wood or coals, letting it burn down is really important, because you always like misjudge how hot a fire really is until you put food on it and you're like, oh crap. That's one mistake that I see often when grilling. But I mean, I really think about it the same way that I think about any other way that I would cook a steak is you just don't overcook it. You know, like you throw it on the grill hot and fast because it's so lean. There's really no fat compared to like a beef steak. And so it doesn't take very long. It gets cooked really fast. And that's why I like to pull it early, at least 30 minutes from the fridge, so that you don't end up with an overly charred outside and cold middle, unless it's what you want.
We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time: Seafoam motor treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. And it's really simple. When you pour it into your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it do its job. Now, you probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again, because people everywhere rely on it to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. So, help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver, off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid, and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something, because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And make sure to use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MEATEATER.
I was going to ask you if you put any fat on the outside. I know some people, they'll coat the steak in like olive oil or something before grilling it.
Yeah, I do that.
You do? Okay.
I do like grapeseed, canola, or avocado oil. First, I season it with salt and pepper way in advance, like early that morning or the night before, if I happen to remember. And then I pull it from the fridge and then kind of like pat it dry and then put oil all over it.
Yeah.
And that's another good point. Like when it comes to like, say, just if all you want to do is salt and pepper your steak, I think that's a great idea, because I mean, as the purest wild game eaters would want to believe, is like, that's all a good steak needs, because the meat tastes really good if you took care of it in the field. And I totally agree. But one thing people don't really consider as much is the type of salt and the type of pepper, because texture really, really matters. And I have gone to the extreme on this. If you've got like a sea salt or like a black pepper, like cruncher, you know,
yep,
those are pretty good, because then you've got some texture on there. I can't stand when those like little tins of black pepper.
Yep.
You know what I'm talking about?
The big chunks.
So like, yeah, I hate those. I've gone kind of extreme lately with all of my steaks now. I I use a sea salt or a kind of a flaky salt, anything that's kind of like a crunchy textural salt, because you can actually just, it just totally changes the meat when you have that texture from the salt. But in addition, I buy peppercorns in bulk. Like, I'll just buy like a bag of them and I stick them in like a little, like a tablespoon worth in a mortar and pestle. And I hand mash all my peppercorns now to rub on my steak, because it's so, the texture is just phenomenally better. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm going a little overboard and extreme with it, but if you're going to just do a salt and pepper for the sake of doing a salt and pepper, like, having that texture really changes it to something significantly better.
Interesting. I get where it does make sense. I totally get what you mean, because I have done, we do sometimes have like a sea salt, which is like a larger flake, I guess. And I have noticed, like, mm-hmm. ooh, that is a nice little extra crunch of sorts, different texture. Yeah. Now, what about the next step from that, which is applying something on the outside, like rubs? What are your thoughts on putting rubs on a big piece of meat or a steak or something like that for grilling? Is that an idea that you ever look at?
Yes. I mean, if it's a steak, so this is like, so here's one example. It's basically a rub, even though I'm just making a salt and pepper steak. I'll do the same thing I was just telling you about, hand mashing those peppercorns. And then I have a big herb garden and I'll snip a thing of rosemary and then take a garlic and mince it and mince the rosemary and then add the salt. And so I've got all three of those things just sort of getting mashed up in that mortar and pestle. And when you're done with it, you've got this like really granule rub, basically, like a garlic and herb rub. And that's kind of like as far as I take a steak usually. Sometimes, depending on what type of steak, like if it's the inside round steak, which is actually a phenomenal steak, as is the sirloin tip, which a lot of people never even think to cut it like a steak, but I do it all the time. Those I kind of do it the, what I call like the cowboy steak. Maybe that's just a Texas thing. But that's salt, pepper, a little cayenne and brown sugar. And let me tell you, that brown sugar caramelizes on the grill. Like, oh, it's my like secret to any kind of rub. Add just a pinch of brown sugar and you just get this like really nice flavor on the grill.
I like that idea a lot. Speaking of these these steaks, if you're cutting your own steaks, what's the ideal thickness in your mind?
Oh, I don't know. I play around with that all the time. When it comes to a backstrap, I do not like the butterfly method. I just think they overcook way too fast for what it is. And so I usually cut the loin out in intervals of like 4-6 inches long. And then other pieces like the inside round, which that cut is kind of like a big rectangle. And so most people kind of do cutlets out of it. And just recently I decided instead that I would cut it crosswise. Instead of cutting a whole bunch of steaks down the whole thing, I cut it through the middle, lengthwise or crosswise. Does that make sense?
Yep, I follow.
Get two wide, flat pieces. And then I took those wide, flat pieces and pounded them out flat. And that's the closest to kind of a fajita-like texture, because it has a really strong grain line. And then you pound it out thin. I mean, I say thin, I mean like maybe an inch. Is that they're like an inch or two, and then you grill it as one whole piece, and you can apply whatever kind of rub you want on it, whether it's like a steak rub, a Cajun, or a whatever you want. And then when it's done, when you go to cut it, you take the knife at a 45 degree angle, so you get these long strips, and the 45 degree angle is so that you get like more surface area of meat versus just cutting it straight down, if that makes sense.
I do.
That's a new thing that I've been doing lately. And it kind of gives you like that fajita-y, like briskety feel, like strips of meat, but it's such a tender cut that, and it's really good for like putting in tacos or on sandwiches, stuff like that. But that's kind of a new thing I've been doing. But most of the time, I like, if I want a steak, I want like a big, thick steak.
Yeah. Inch, 2 inches, something like that?
Yeah. Yeah, at least. Yeah, I would say.
Now, okay.
I don't know. I just like to feel like I'm biting into something.
Yeah, I hear you on that one. And then also, I feel like you just get, at least in the past when I've had processors do my meat and you get those back, they cut those steaks so thin and it's just so easy to overcook
them. They really do.
It's lousy. Mm-hmm. So that is a beautiful thing of processing your own meat, is to be able to get those cuts just the way you want them and allow for that thicker, better piece of, better bite, better, you know, easier to cook with. But so there's the salt and pepper method that you talked about. There's some rub ideas. I like your rub ideas. The third way that I could see people thinking about steaks or working with wild game in the summer would be marinades. A lot of people talk about using marinades. I know you just did a whole big rundown for the Meat Eater website about your thoughts on, you know, why, when, and how to use wild game marinades. And I want to kind of hear your thoughts on that, especially in regards to venison, but everything too. What's your take there, and how should we be thinking about marinades?
You know, like, I think maybe this is just the way people are, but it seems like people just like they're just like really all for something, or they're really all against it. And I don't really find, I mean, I've been on both sides. When I very first started cooking wild game, I was like, well, this is supposed to be gamey, let's put it in a marinade. And then after I like really got into it, I'm like, this is too good for that. I would never use a marinade. How dare you?
Right.
And now I'm like a little more equilibrium and realizing that there is a time and a place where I think marinades are really helpful. I don't really love them on my steak. It's not how I would choose to eat a steak, but there are a lot of other cuts that could benefit from having a marinade. If you have like a lesser, like if you have, say like the sirloin tip or some sort of cut, like the tri-tip or something that's sort of tender, but it's, you know, not a tenderloin or anything. Those do well under a marinade. Or game birds, like turkey, pheasant, all those kind of things. I love marinating those meats. And I really like to think as a marinade primarily being used to add flavor and not so much as a tenderizer. I think people kind of get back and forth about whether or not it tenderizes. And science has proven that a marinade could really only like permeate a meat about an eighth of an inch. So if you've got like a huge hunk of meat, you're not really doing much for it. But a marinade usually contains some sort of salt, and salt can do amazing things for meat. It helps it stay like really juicy whenever you cook it, like a kind of like a brine, the way you brine a turkey. And so that's like a positive thing of using marinades, is you get to eat like a very juicy, flavorful meat. And if you're eating, you know, salt and pepper steaks all the time, it can get a little boring. Like having something different is nice. I like that for a change. And I think some cuts really benefit from that, like a heart. You know, a lot of people have a hard time eating it in general, and a lot of people think that there's a real irony taste to it, or, you know, it's a stronger flavored meat.
Yes, unique.
And I think marinating it can really, really be a great thing for things like that. So I like marinades. I use them like whole shoulders, like whole big cuts that I plan to cook later on. Like I'll marinate it in some sort of rub, or not a rub, like a paste or like some sort of liquid. And then I'll actually cook it in that liquid. So like that's a new way. I think when people think of marinades, they automatically assume like a kebab on the grill or something like that. But there's like some other traditions where they'll take meat, soak it in like a vinegary marinade, and then when they take it out, they just boil it inside that marinade, which is actually a fantastic way of cooking really tough cuts. So that's something I started doing a lot with like the shoulders and just really tough cuts of meat, is marinating it and then throwing it in the crock pot and cooking it in the marinade. It's like you couldn't really make it easier.
Yeah. When you're doing something like that or whatever you're marinating, how long do you have to let it marinate for?
You know, if, like I was saying, there's really, since it can't like go very deep into the meat, like marinating for days isn't really a great idea. I did a marinade recently for a tri-tip. It's like lemon juice, rosemary, garlic, and oil. And it's a really good summer marinade for grilling. And I'll do steaks that way sometimes. But I forgot about it. I was going to cook it. And then we've got a trap out here at the ranch. And we trapped a bunch of pigs. And then I was like, oh, crap, we need to go out there and take care of that. And then, like, 2 days later, I came back. And I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot about the steaks we were going to cook. And I took it out in the marinade. And the meat was just gray. The inside was fine. But once I cooked it, it was like just eating it looked very unappealing because that lemon juice and that acid had just changed the outside. So I think there's definitely a limit on how long is too long. I think 2 days is too long. But if you're just trying to add flavor to it, you know, anywhere from 4, 8, 12 hours window is good. So if you do it the night before you plan to cook, I think that's a perfectly good amount of time.
Okay. What are some of your go-to marinades? I know you published a venison kebab recipe recently, and you mentioned one in there that you like a lot. What are those? What's that look like?
Let's see. My go-tos are kind of like, it's like, what do I want to eat today? And sometimes in my head, I like take a little trip around the world. I'm like, oh, Mediterranean sounds really awesome. And so if you have turkey, having some sort of like Greek yogurt or like something like that in your marinade, like totally changes the flavor profile. Or buttermilk. Like I have a quail recipe that's just buttermilk and I don't even remember what all is in it. Probably a bunch of herbs and garlic. But when it comes to steak and venison, I don't really like to get anything too crazy or too bold. I really just keep it to sort of the same category of something acidic, whether it's a red wine vinegar or a lemon juice, and then some fresh herbs. Rosemary and thyme are usually my favorites, and then garlic. Those are kind of my, like, the things that I always add in the marinade. And then, of course, either salt. So I think the kebab recipe uses soy sauce, but most of the time I'll just add just sea salt or something. And then, like I was saying before, sugar. I think sugar helps balance out like how like puckery it tastes, but once it hits that grill, you totally notice whether or not there was sugar because it gives you that like caramelized flavor.
Yeah.
Oh, I have one more.
Yeah.
Tex-Mex. That's something that I eat like on a weekly basis just because it's been ingrained into my culture. And since I was born, it's just, I eat Tex-Mex. It's a huge part of my life, which for me, that is just always equal parts lemon juice, orange juice, garlic, sometimes onion, oregano, cumin, salt, pepper, chilies, cilantro. There's a recipe online.
Yeah. So what kind of meal would you plan with that kind of marinade or that kind of set of spices?
Like a Mexican-y kind of flavor.
Yep.
The heart is a really good one because it's so tender. You can slice a heart, then marinate it, and then cook it like that. I always recommend people who are eating heart for the first time to try the fajita marinade and put it in a taco or something. I just think it's a more approachable way to eat a heart. But I use it, like I was saying, like if you have like a tender top round or something like that, that anything like with a strong grain line of the meat will make a really good fajita or steak meat. And then it's really versatile for turkeys or any other white meat too. It works kind of across the board. It just depends on what cut you're using on a deer, like how tough it is. Because you don't really want to grill a tough cut.
Right. You got me thinking, though, as you mentioned this Tex-Mex marinade, what are some other things we can be thinking about as far as summer Mexican Tex-Mex kind of themed meals with our venison or other wild game for this time of year? Because I mean, I eat a lot of Mexican food all through the year, but especially summer, it seems like such a great thing to eat outside or out in the boat or wherever. Yeah. You mentioned fajitas. That's an easy one to tackle. But do you have any tips on either how to make your fajitas better or anything else that's a little bit outside of the ordinary?
You know, fajitas are hard because the cut of meat is so important. You know, like when you go get a fajita at a steakhouse or at a restaurant, you know, you're eating a skirt or a flank steak, which is a really thin, flappy cut of meat. And then they cut it against the grain line when they cook it. And it's just cooked really hot and fast. And I've tried doing that with deer before. I've never had a deer big enough where the flank was big enough to cook. And by the time I got the silver skin off, I was left with like this pancake,
yeah.
Like this tiny thing. And I was like, that looked so like misshapen and weird. And I was like, this isn't going to work. Just grind it. And then I've tried brisket, which works very well if you get all the silver skin off, which is a bear. It's a project. And I do it every now and then. And every time I do it, I'm like, that's really a lot of work. But you get the closest result to like the actual cut of meat that you would get at the steakhouse. And then just recently, like I was saying, with that inside round or like the what you would get a hand steak out of from a deer, that piece cut through the middle long ways to get two wide rectangles. That is probably the closest way of creating the same texture of meat. So I think the cut of meat is really the most important. But if you didn't want to do like fajitas, if you wanted to do something else, let me think. What else do I do?
Do you ever do tamales?
You know, I used to work in the cooking classes at Sur La Table, and we used to do those a lot. And I never carried that on. And I never do that at home, mostly because like the community and the culture where I live, there's a strong, strong Hispanic influence. And those women who make tamales for like a dollar are just so freaking good at it. And I'm like, why would I compete with it when I can go and get these tamales from these women who've been doing it from their grandmother and their grandmother, you know, like passed down from generation. Like, it's just so hard to like, when you have something like that, I'm like, and the same thing with tortillas. You know, I feel the same way when I can get these homemade tortillas down the street. I'm like, they're just so much better than what I can do.
Yeah, I'm very jealous.
I'm willing to admit that.
I'm very jealous about that right now. When we're on this Mexican coos deer hunt, I guess it was almost a year and a half ago or so. And so we were having fresh homemade tortillas every day, and we made tamales with someone down there who helped us do it the right way. And golly, we brought some of those home, and that was great, but there's no way I could replicate it. So,
well, the thing about it is like the way you make it, you don't just make a few tamales. You make like 100 tamales,
right?
You know, like you don't just do small batches because it just requires a lot of work. So you just do a ton of it. And then I'm also like, what am I going to do with all these tamales? who's going to eat these? Mm-hmm. No, those are, you know, like there's part of me that wants to cook everything. And then there's the side of me that realizes that there are some people who are just so good at it. And like, when I taste their food, like I just allow myself to just enjoy and respect what they do. And I don't feel like the pressure to try to replicate it.
Yeah. So if somebody was visiting your house, or mm-hmm. maybe I came down to the ranch and, you know, was eating some of the things that you cook, what would be the thing that I or a visiting cook would say, oh, there's no way I should try cooking that at home, because that's Danielle's thing. She's just so good at that. What's that specialty that no one could compare with?
I don't know if I have that.
Oh, come on. Don't be too modest.
I don't know.
You've got to have that home run that you just know is going to be great every time that people want.
You know, a lot of my friends know me as like the girl who cooks duck and geese. I think I just have cooked it so many times that people just always want me to cook steakhouse goose. That's kind of one of my specialties, although I don't think it's that challenging because I use a sous vide, so it's like cheating. But people love that one. And then what else do I do? I would say I do Tex-Mex really well. I would say if you came over, I would have fresh salsa, a good roasted salsa, or like a roasted corn and poblano salsa, or like a fresh pico de gallo. I'm like one of those people who believe that you should have a smorgasbord of stuff. Like I would definitely have guacamole. And I will definitely have either a verde sauce or roasted tomato sauce salsa. And then probably a fresh pulled pico de gallo or some sort of fresh salsa, like depending on what time of the year, like summer, I'll definitely pull as many vegetables together to get some sort of fresh salsa. And then it just depends on whatever I throw or pull out of the freezer. Like carnitas, I do quite a bit. Carnitas with hog is fantastic. Or we live near the coast, and so we have a lot of redfish, and so I'll do fish tacos. Yeah, I would say if you came to my house, the best thing I make is some sort of Tex-Mex, mostly because like you're just going to have like 10 things to eat from.
That sounds very, very good. So if I'm trying to do something like you just described, so I'm going to fix up either, you know, a fajita recipe or tacos or carnitas or something, but I want to spice it up a little bit. And when I say spice, not literally, I mean figuratively. I want to make it this next level kind of Mexican night. Taco Tuesday. We do our Taco Tuesdays here. What would that smorgasbord tip be? Or what would be, you know, that fresh salsa? What would someone do to just kind of level up their game on that front?
Well, step one is choose what you're eating. You know, I wouldn't serve the same salsa that I serve with redfish that I would a deer. Well, actually, yeah, I would. I probably would. That's a lie.
Are there certain types of salsas that pair with certain types of meats, though? Is there a certain, like, if I'm thinking about my salsas, is there certain types that pair with venison versus something else, or?
No, I mean, I guess no, not really. I think it depends on more how you want to serve it. Like if you were doing, like, a ground meat taco, I wouldn't want a roasted corn poblano, if that makes sense.
Because of the texture?
If you're doing a ground, I don't know, it just seems weird. Yeah, you got like a corn and it's like real bunch of little circles, and then you got a ground meat, which is more circles. I don't want this is okay. I think about everything not only in terms of flavor, but in terms of texture. So like shapes and softness and crunchiness and like all those things should all like that's what makes something really good. You know, if you have a taco and you've got, say, you got grilled fish tacos. The fish are soft because they're grilled. you know, like having something like a little crunchy added into the taco, like in like a salsa with some radishes with for that crunch. You know, like all those little things start to play together. And if you've got fried fish or fried something, you know, think how good like sour cream or guacamole is, because you've got like counterbalancing like textures there. But I don't know how to answer your question. What, how do I take a taco to the next level? Is that the question?
Yeah, like, I mean, salsa? Yeah, would there be a salsa? Or I guess I'm wondering is, for the average person out there listening, if they want to take one suggestion from you to improve their Mexican night or whatever, their meal tonight, and they want to, since that's your specialty, is there like a homemade salsa they should consider? Or would it be as simple as what you just said, which was add the counterbalance of texture, which I think is a great tip.
I would say counterbalance the texture for sure, because if everything in your taco is real soft and mushy, you notice it. And you got a soft shell tortilla or a tortilla versus like a hard shell or something like that. Or even something simple like shredded lettuce adds texture. But I would say if you wanted to up your taco game, learning how to make a really good fresh salsa, either a roasted tomato salsa or a pico de gallo. And I prefer pico de gallo, something cold now that it's summer, and say you're going to grill something like a venison, even if it's just a steak, or like say you got a steak and you want to just use salt, pepper, cayenne, and brown sugar, and you rub that on the steak. I would do some sort of cold salsa on the side. And I keep saying salsa. I should say pico de gallo, which is usually a blend of tomatoes, red onion, cilantro, jalapeno, lime juice. And then, like, depending on what you have on hand, then you can start adding other things. Like, I think corn is really, really good in that. Yeah, that's one thing I make. I call it the cowboy sandwich, which is that same rub on a steak, cut really, really thin, and then you put it on an open face sandwich, and with a corn salsa on top.
Oh man,
it's good. Actually, that the first time I met my husband's parents, that's what they made me. Maybe that's why I like it so much.
It sounds good to me. I like that idea a lot. Speaking of sandwiches, then now my mind's turning to burgers, and I was just thinking about this whole texture thing you talked about, how you want to add crunch or you want to add softness depending on what you're making. When it comes to taking your burger game to the next level, which is another thing a lot of people are trying to do this time of year, what are some of your thoughts on that when it comes to making a better venison burger on the grill?
You know, I season heavily on burgers just because they can get bland really quick, but I don't really like to, I don't get crazy and add like chopped bacon or cheese or do any of that stuff. I'm a straight up just meat and some fat. I do like fat. I'll do like a 15% fat added to my meat mixture. My husband actually likes it 100% venison, which gets a little crumbly sometimes. But I like to add fat, and then I really do go pretty heavily on the salt and pepper on the outside of it. I don't actually, well, no, I'll do it in the mix. So like before you form the patties, I'll blend in salt and pepper to the mix, and then make the patties. I guess there's a lot of different ways you could do it, but that's probably the best.
Yeah.
Because you really need to emulsify the meat and the fat together after you've ground it up, so that it sticks a little better. And so adding that salt and pepper right after you, well, I guess, okay. So this is another thing I should mention. I grind all my meat before I cook it.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned this last time. That was, sounded like a lot of work.
Yeah. No, is it? No, I don't think it's a, maybe. So I guess that's probably why I would say that I would do it this way, as opposed to somebody else who's like already has their meat ground up. Do you form patties and then freeze it, or you just like have the ground meat?
So yeah, I've just got ground meat packaged. I grind it when I do my processing, and then it's packaged, and then I'll defrost it. And now I've just got a block of defrosted burger. And then what I usually personally would do is I would add an egg, and I make patties, and then I would salt and pepper just before putting on the grill is what I've historically done. But now you're making me think maybe I should try adding it before I create the patties.
Yeah, kind of almost the same way like you would think of why a sausage flavoring is so good is because all that seasoning's already blended in. You know, you don't season the outside of a sausage. Although it's still wrapped in casing, but I used to do the egg method, and if I have 100% ground venison, I'll add an egg. But if there's enough fat, like 15%, 10 to 15%, then I'll try to make it stick together without the egg. And then, you know, I'm not like super picky about how it's cooked. I mean, I personally like it on a cast iron. My husband would disagree and say it's better on the grill. We argue a lot about grilling because I think it's his territory a little bit. Kind of, not really, but I'll let him have it sometimes. I don't think there's a better way. I don't think that one way is necessarily better than the other. I think it just depends on what you like. You know, like if you've got a really good charcoal grill going, then absolutely, I think putting it directly on the grill is the way to go. But if you're using a propane, I just assume you might as well put it in a cast iron.
Why is that?
And get a really good sear.
Just because the propane grill isn't going to get as hot or as direct to heat, or what's the thing there?
Well, I think charcoal produces a better flavor, and I think you get like actual flavor from the flames. Versus a propane, to me, has a specific like flavor to it. You can tell the difference when it's cooked over a propane versus charcoal. And I like the cast iron because you can put oil in the bottom of it and get a solid sear across the whole burger. You know, like a flat top griddle cooking kind of mentality.
Yeah.
I don't always do it that way. I do it with my steaks, sometimes my burgers. I mean, I'm kind of back and forth on it, but I think it just depends on what you're cooking over. If you've got a fire or charcoal, I think it's better directly on the grill grates.
What about a mistake I used to make a lot when I first started trying to grill venison burgers? And this is when I like just started trying to cook myself. You know, like in college, and I would throw a patty on the grill, and then I just would keep flipping it. I'd flip it, and then I'd want to check it. So I'd check the bottom side, I'd flip it again, and then I'd check it, and I'd flip it again. And then I eventually read somewhere that you really don't want to do that. At least what I remember is that they said put it on the one side, let it cook something like 60 to 70% through on that side, and then flip it just to kind of sear the other side, and then you're done. Something like that. So I only do one flip now. Is there anything to that? Am I just living off of some weird article I read a long time ago?
No, that's good advice. The more you flip it, the more your chances are you might mess it up or like crumble or, you know, like just you. When it comes to cooking, like I used to have this habit of like the same sort of thing, like stir, 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 like. You feel like you always need to mess with it because you don't want to mess it up. So you're always like messing with food and checking it. And you kind of lose the meat's like ability to sort of char and get all that flavor and the caramelization that happens. You know, like so the best foods are always like, let it like put the meat down and leave it alone. Like, let it work its magic. Like you messing with it isn't making it better.
Yeah.
You know, like you it needs time for the flames and that like mired reaction to take place and to sort of caramelize and to work. Because when you flip it, you're just kind of, I don't want to say you're baking it, but you're not creating the same crust as if you had just left it there.
Yeah. Yeah, that crust
and
that you
grill
get.
Marks.
Yeah, that seems to be the key. Yeah, it adds that texture, right? I feel like sometimes I've made burger patties that don't have that grill mark or crust on the outside. And it's kind of like soft, mushy. But those really good burgers are the ones that have like that firm or crunchy outside. In my opinion, it seems like.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what it is you've allowed it to sort of do its thing and create that crust on the outside. And that's sort of why I like the cast iron so much. Sometimes you create a crust on the outside and it's like full coverage over the meat versus a grill grate. You're only getting like a few lines, like the grill marks. I think a lot of that's just personal preference though.
Yeah. Now how do you go
about either way?
Yeah. How do you go about making sure you don't overcook your burgers? What's your way of telling when they're done?
Intuition. you can poke and you can feel it and you can, you know, kind of like the way you check for the doneness of a steak, you can kind of feel how it's cooked, you know, honestly, that's probably the best answer is feeling it. Also, as they start to release juices too, so start to notice the juice as it comes out, what it looks like and how much. When you don't see any juice coming out anymore, you've dried it out. And I honestly like mine steaks to still be a little pink in the middle. Not raw by any means, but I don't like a well done steak.
And same thing for burgers. You like a medium rare burger?
I don't like a well done burger.
Yeah. So speaking of checking doneness, I didn't ask you when it comes to steaks. One thing I used to do like the hand trick where you put your middle finger and your thumb together. And or different fingers with your thumb, and that tells you like how a steak should feel when it's a certain. So I've heard like if you put your index finger and your thumb together, that's what a raw steak will feel like. And if you put your middle finger and your thumb together, that's you should be poking like that pad.
Medium rare. Yeah.
I'm talking about poking this little pad of your hand underneath your thumb. That's what I'm touching. I heard that. And then that kind of worked, but then I decided to start using a meat thermometer. So now I use a meat thermometer, and I actually try to see what the temperature is and then take it off at the right time. But one of the things I've wondered is, can you poke a piece of meat too many times? Because I've found I'm poking it, you know, I'm checking and checking and checking, and now it's three pokes in there, four pokes, and juices are coming out when I poke. Is that a bad thing I'm doing?
Yeah, you know, checking it once isn't the end of the world. Maybe three times is a little bit much because each time you do that, juices leave the meat. So, you know, after you're done cooking a steak, there's always the instructions, let it rest, because juices go back into the meat tissues instead of all over your plate. So every time you poke it, that's how much juice is gone from the meat that won't reabsorb.
Yep. That's what I worried about.
Yeah. I mean, I think meat thermometers can be a good thing, especially if you are intimidated by like cooking a steak and you want something to be just right and you're excited about it. I think it's a good thing that you use it. My problem is that meat thermometers aren't really always accurate. I have two meat thermometers. And they're never saying the same thing.
Yikes.
And so that's like one thing that I'm like, well, how much more accurate is this meat thermometer than like the years of cooking and my intuition and feeling like what's actually better at this point? I mean, I think it takes time to get there, but I think meat thermometers can be a really good thing. I think what's probably more helpful is the first time you pull it out to check that doneness. And if you feel it and it's like mega squishy, like, you know, you can do the finger test and you're like, okay, well, that's probably needs more time. Don't worry about poking it. Just stick it back in the oven for a minute or two.
Yeah.
And then try again instead of having like to do it three times, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that does. That does. Another, I'm pivoting here a little bit, but if I'm thinking about all the things that I want to cook over the next week as I enjoy some nice summer weather, and I'm thinking, okay, Mexican food's a great thing to eat during the summer. Burgers, of course, steaks, of course. Another thing that I know a lot of people like to get after is some kind of barbecue or smoking meats if they've got a smoker. Do you have any thoughts on those types of preparations? Do you guys experiment with that at all, with venison or anything?
You know, a little bit, but not a lot. I'm actually getting ready to get a smoker soon just because there's so many things that I want to smoke and I haven't had a whole lot of opportunity. Other than out here at the ranch, we have like a big pit smoker, but we don't always use it because it's just so time consuming. But, you know, now these days, pellet smokers make things really, really easy. But I kind of approach barbecuing, smoking very similarly to the way I would approach any other tough cut. And it's the same low and slow method. And with wild game, it can dry out really, really easily. You know, if you think about like what makes a really good barbecue so delicious, like a brisket or something like that. And, you know, they create a bark and they've got these beautiful smoky flavors, but you're also sinking your teeth into like a layer of fat. You know, your pork ribs, there's a layer of fat in there that wild game doesn't have. And so that's probably the number one thing you should consider if you're going to try to like do venison ribs or like a whole or whatever you're going to do, like a shoulder barbecue or something like that. Is just consider that fat's not there. And one of the things that I want to do is experimenting a little more with smoking it mostly for flavor and then kind of doing the cheater method where you then either wrap it in foil and have some sort of liquid in there to finish so it doesn't dry out, or transferring it to the oven or a crock pot to finish. Just because I know that if you just leave it in there to smoke the whole time, it's going to get pretty dry.
Yeah.
We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time. Seafoam motor treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. And it's really simple. When you pour it into your gas tank, seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it do its job. Now, you probably know someone who's used a can of seafoam to get their truck or boat going again, because people everywhere rely on it to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. So, help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something, because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And make sure to use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MEATEATER.
Yeah, it's funny you mention it. This is exactly what I've been experimenting with recently. And I've done it with like a big roast off the haunch one time. And then I actually use a back strap to do it once, where I basically put it on my Traeger and let it run at 250 degrees for a couple hours. And then I found a recipe somewhere that talked about doing this. So I was just kind of following this recipe. So what they said is use, I think, a chuck roast or something. I can't remember what it was they used, but they said to run it for 3.5 hours till you reach 160 degrees and then wrap it in foil and fill the foil with beef broth and then finish it for another hour and a half in beef broth wrapped in foil. So I did that exactly with that first roast, and it got, I mean, it was very, very good, but it was dry on the inside still. So what I did is you take it out, you've got this kind of looks like a brisket, and then I just sliced it up real thin, and then we ate it on sandwiches. So I tried it the second time with a back strap, and I was going to do the same kind of deal, have like a back strap brisket style sandwich. And I'd reduced the cooking time on the front end pre-broth significantly to try to just keep the internal temperature lower to try to get more of a medium rare finish by the time I was done for the inside to try to keep that moisture. And it was a little better, but still pretty dry.
So
I don't know how to keep the inside juicy while getting that crust on the outside. Right now, it's still pretty darn good, but I just don't have the juiciness, which I would prefer.
Would you say the first temperature was 250 and then you went to 350?
No. So I kept the cooking temperature at 250 degrees on the Traeger the whole time, but you run it until the internal temperature of the meat was 160 degrees is what it said. Once the internal's at 160, then you're supposed to wrap it in foil, fill it with broth, and then run it until it reaches 200. But that
backstrap, you didn't cook it to 200 internal though.
Correct. For the backstrap, the backstrap, I took it off in the 150s.
So like if you wanted it to be medium rare, I would have taken it out at 140.
Yep.
But I think 250 is, well, it's still low enough. I would have tried even a little lower, maybe at 200, 215, or 225. And that's pretty low. But meat, like whenever it gets heated, it's kind of like, if you think about a towel that's wet, so if you wanted to wring it out, you twist it to get all that like water out of a towel.
Right.
The same thing happens whenever a meat's being cooked. Those fibers start contracting and things kind of start to like lose all of its moisture. And that happens at 100, it starts happening at like 188 degrees. And so usually like when I think about low cooking, like in the 225 range is a good number. But I think smoking is a really dry heat method, even though that first half, it's still like being a dry heat. I think it was probably just too long of a dry heat.
Yeah.
And also another thing is, did you brine it beforehand?
No brine.
Put a rub on it?
I put a rub on it.
That'll make a really big difference. Any kind of rub or a brine beforehand will make a world of difference.
So what I did is I did a rub, which I just put olive oil on the piece of meat, and then on top of I used a rub of salt, pepper, cayenne pepper, and brown sugar, I think was what I used. Mixed all that up and then applied that as a rub on the outside. And yeah, so that gets me the crust, but the brine, I guess, you're saying it's like a saltwater brine?
Yep, just like a turkey.
Interesting. I've never done that for venison.
And it's a weird, weird thing to think about with the backstrap, and I'll do kind of the same approach, but I do it with a sous vide, but at 24 hours ahead, I just rub the whole thing with salt and pepper, like a generous rub with salt and pepper, and I just leave it alone inside my fridge for at least 24 hours. And you can soak it in a thing of water if you want, but I think it's just as effective to just rub it with salt and pepper. So like if you have your favorite rub or whatever you want to like barbecue with, just use that.
Just well ahead of time.
And do it like 24. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You'll notice a huge difference. I'll be honest. I don't have a pellet grill, so I haven't really messed around with some of those things. I'll be getting one soon. and I'll better be able to tell you how to make that better. But off my first thought, I think the front end with the dry cooking is too much.
Yeah.
Too long or something.
Yeah, I'm gonna keep messing with it because it's really good. I mean it's darn good as it is, the flavoring and stuff. It's just the thing to put it over the top to just drop your jaw kind of good would be to get those cuts extra moist. So I'm gonna keep playing with it because it's I'm a fan of it. Now here's something.
Yeah, the brine will help.
Yeah, here's something kind of the total opposite of that. It's a sandwich, but it's kind of like your simplest kind of sandwich. When I grew up, what my grandma called a barbecue sandwich was just essentially like a sloppy Joe. It was just ground meat, and I think she put brown sugar and ketchup and mustard and stirred it all up and cooked that, and that was this, and onions. And this was like, for whatever reason, the thing. We loved it growing up. I saw you took a stab at making a fancy sloppy Joe. I think we talked about this.
Fancy sloppy Joe.
Well, didn't you try to do an improved version of a sloppy Joe? I feel like that you were trying to.
No, I made the regular old sloppy Joe, I think.
Well, then what's? I haven't tried your recipe yet, but tell me how to make a good sloppy Joe then, because that's a good summer sandwich if you want something like that.
So the way I approach the sloppy Joe thing was, okay, I went through dozens of traditional sloppy Joe recipes, and I kept seeing the same theme over and over. And so what I translate those ingredients to be is a convenient way to make a barbecue sauce, you know, the ketchup and all that. And so I basically just broke it down and simplified it. But because I'm from Texas and barbecue is a bit of a religion around here, I just sort of imparted my Texas barbecue influence on that. And so I don't have a barbecue sauce in that. No, my sloppy Joe does have ketchup in it. I did make it like a barbecue sauce. So I do so many recipes, I can't always remember what I did exactly. No, I basically broke it down and made like a barbecue sauce with it. But the difference between like mine and maybe what you had is I have a lot of black pepper and like a pinch of cumin. The cumin is kind of what makes it a little Texan. Probably what you're not used to in the seasonings of finding in a sloppy Joe recipe. But it, to me, it tastes kind of like the barbecue flavor that I grew up eating and that we eat around here. It's definitely a peppery, ketchupy, sugary ground meat concoction.
It's that cumin's kind of the taco, traditional taco seasoning kind of flavor, right? If we're trying to like relate this to someone. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Just a hint. It's not something that I think you necessarily know is there when you try it, but it's you know something's different, but you're not really sure how to put your finger on it.
Yeah.
And it's very, very Texan.
What have we missed? If we're talking summer venison or other wild game, is there something that's just like a screaming miss that you would be making over the coming months that we've got to touch on for people? Or do you feel like we've covered kind of the mainstays?
I think those are the main things. I think those are the main things, unless you want to add in like camping, you know, like,
Ooh, do you have some camp meal ideas?
Yeah. My favorite thing to cook is fish, which probably sounds like the worst thing you'd want to eat while camping. But if you're truck camping, or maybe you're camping by the beach or by the river and you're catching fish, cooking it over the open fire is like the best camp food for me. I just love it. And I think part of that comes from living near the coast. We have redfish. And so when you fillet those out, you can eat them on the half shell, which basically means you keep the scales and the skin on when you fillet them. And that becomes its own cooking vessel. So you basically just put it right on the grill grate or whatever grate over a fire. That to me is like my absolute favorite camp meal. And I've gotten to the habit now, my favorite way to like prepare it, besides just salt and pepper, is I start bringing along pickle jars because acidity just pairs so well with everything. And so, I just bring little jars of different types of pickles. I've been pickling stuff from my garden. And then when you eat it, you just pour that cold pickling over it. And it's just so good.
So hold on. You're pouring pickle juice on your fish fillets?
Not like the juice necessarily. Like I'll do, like the last one I did was a pickled relish with like chopped green beans, onions, and jalapenos pickled. And so I just take the relish out and pour that over. But if you have like sort of that like gardenia sort of pickling stuff, or like the relish, or just pickled peppers or pickled pickles, not necessarily the juice, but just like the actual pickle,
gotcha,
pickling ingredient.
Okay. Now, doing it that half shell method, you're doing it with redfish. I'm assuming you do the same thing with a bass or a trout or whatever you're catching wherever you live.
It's a little different. So what makes the redfish so special about the half shell thing is you keep the scales on, because the scales are really hard. Like they're, I don't know. Have you ever had redfish before?
I have not.
Okay. Their scales are like mega hard versus like, you know, any other fish, you could take a bottle cap and scale it.
Yeah.
A redfish is, you just cannot scale it. I mean, you can, but you like, it's a real pain to scale a redfish. So you keep it all on there, and that's what protects it and sort of keeps the skin and everything together, and it basically hardens on the grill. And so other fish, if you wanted to do it that route, I would just cook it whole. So like you would go ahead and scale, like I do this with speckled trout. I'll scale it and then make some slash marks, and sometimes I'll stuff it with herbs or lemon, and then put oil it really, really well and put that directly on the grill. The whole fish.
And then you just open it up and pull out some delicious flaky meat.
Yeah, I mean, after it's cooked, the fillet just comes right off so easily.
That sounds pretty good. That sounds very good. It's approaching, not quite approaching dinner time, but enough that I'm getting hungry as we talk about all this stuff over here. So
I know, I haven't had lunch yet.
Oh, geez. You got to get to that, Daniel. I got to let you go.
I know.
Okay. So this is good. I feel like I'm armed with some new ideas here for the coming months. One thing we haven't talked about, and I know you've experimented with some of these things, and I haven't got to try them yet, are new meat eater spices. Are there any that you can recommend for some of these summer dishes we've been talking about that we could try?
Yeah, you know, all the barbecue ones are good. I'll say if you're going to go with the barbecue ones, they're sweet. So be careful on the grill with really high heat, because you don't want it to burn. But they're really, really good. So like if you're doing something on a low temperature, like a pellet grill, they're perfect. I can't remember the names of them, but we have two barbecue flavored.
Yeah, there's the Beaver Trapper rub. Barbecue rub.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the other one?
Then there's a Drunken Squirrel Hickory Bourbon rub.
Yeah. Those two.
Yeah.
I think the Mastodon is a great one because it's so textural. I just think grilling, there's just something about having a really textural rub. If you're going to do a steak, like if you wanted to go that route, I think it's a really, really good one. And I've actually found that the Mastodon works really well with fish, which sounds kind of weird, but, I've been playing with that. I was in Oregon earlier in the year and I got some halibut, and, I was doing some searing with that, and that rub was just fantastic with it.
Excellent.
But, what else? Yeah.
Well, we've got plenty of cooking ideas and options for all of us to get to now. So it's funny right now, you know, we're under quarantine in some certain ways. We're starting to come out of it now up here in Michigan, but we've been locked down for a long time. And then I also have got a newborn kid. So with two little kids and lockdown, my wife and I have felt just like claustrophobic, just like stuck with nothing interesting to do in our lives anymore. And so the one thing that has been like the spice it up factor has been trying new recipes. We've been trying a bunch of different things. And just that change of pace is such a nice thing to add to your day-to-day existence that I think this summer, I want to take this conversation we had today and just use this to launch my summer into the summer of better wild game food at the Kenyon household. So thank you for helping kickstart us on that, Danielle.
You're welcome. I hope I had some helpful tips.
Definitely. Definitely did. Where can people find all your recipes and all sorts of good stuff and follow along with what you got going on?
So most of everything you'll find is on the Meat Eater website, definitely all the wild game stuff. And I'm pretty active on social media. So my Instagram handle, which is Danielle Pruitt.
Perfect. Okay. Well, good stuff, Danielle. This has been a lot of fun. I appreciate taking time to do this.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. And that's going to do it for us today. So thank you so much for tuning in. Hopefully this one got you armed with some new ideas for the upcoming meals you're planning this coming weekend or week or vacation, whatever it is. And if you want to get more from Danielle, make sure to check out the Meat Eater website. That's themeateater.com for all of her recipes, as well as a whole lot more from other contributors from the Meat Eater website too. Lots of good food ideas there. So check it out. And until next time, thanks for listening and stay wired to hunt.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.